You're listening to Louisiana Insider, a superlative guide to a great state's destinations, hosted by Errol Labor, executive editor of Louisiana Life magazine.
It's our Louisiana song. It's our favorite melody. It's our Louisiana song. Hearing it echo through the cypress tree.
Hey, we're going to be talking about the region today and the whole Louisiana, Mississippi, and the parishes around there. And with me is Michael Hecht, who's really one of the important people in New Orleans, if not the most important, in terms of economic development. He is the president and CEO of an organization called G&O Inc. And to kind of shorten a complicated story, you know, a lot of cities used to have chambers of commerce, and there was expanding and deleting and moving back and forth, and they split into regional chambers. And but anyway, ultimately, I think it was in 2014, they scheduled and placed them with the Chamber of Commerce, an organization, probably a better comprehensive organization called G&O Inc. So that's the group that's out there leading the charge and getting a lot of business. And this isn't just a New Orleans thing, because anything you're doing for New Orleans, you're affecting the whole region. So, hi, Michael.
Hey, Errol, great to be with you. Happy 24.
Thank you. Well, let me ask a simple question. How are we doing? I mean, if you look at Louisiana, if you look at the southern part of Louisiana, the river parishes and going to the Mississippi, are things getting better?
Like somebody famously recently said, it depends on context. That worked out well for her. She's available. If you look at 2022, we're doing a whole lot better than 2022. 2022 was a rough year, tail end of COVID, Hurricane Ida, crime surge. 2023 was a comeback from all of that. Crime down about 30%, tourists flocking back, lots of money for infrastructure. So in that sense, we're doing much better. But if you compare us to, you know, what's happening across the South in a longer and larger context, then we still have a long way to go. As new Governor Landry has pointed out, Louisiana is one of the few states in the South that is losing population. And New Orleans has lost population recently. And the region, which had been flat, actually lost population last year. So I think in a broader context, we clearly have work to do in terms of creating the conditions where companies want to risk their capital and people want to raise their families.
So I've had several people, including a demographer that we had on this show recently, why are we losing the population? And I've yet to get a straight answer. She said it had a lot to do with one with death rates and people moving out and that sort of thing and crime. Why are we losing population?
It's three reasons. I mean, like, I obsess about this and we don't need to be too technical about it. I think it's three things. One is people are moving to opportunity. So it's just economic opportunity being greater in places like Houston or Atlanta. The second is quality of life concerns relative to flood and crime safety. And the third is cost of living. When you have the challenges compounded by rising insurance rates, for example, it becomes a question of, is it worth it? And I think that many people have made the unfortunate but understandable determination that they love this place, but better to live in Dallas and Nashville and just visit for Jazz Fest or Mardi Gras rather than grit it out the whole time. And then all of that, Errol, is wrapped in the need for us to have a better narrative at the city and state level, a more positive, proactive narrative that broadens the perspective of what is going on or beyond just food and music and Mardi Gras, and correct some of the misperceptions around the challenges. So it's some maybe three really substantive things, and then that's wrapped in a narrative challenge.
Well, we've been hearing for years that one of the big problems is that we don't have enough industry in New Orleans and enough manufacturing. And remember at the time, all the hopes were in Eastern New Orleans, really being able to develop a big industrial base. And you know, when we have transportation around here, so why hasn't that happened? Why haven't we gotten the industry people have been talking about?
Well, you know, the industry actually is now coming back in a very strong way. It's one of the reasons that Lawrence Scott, when he gave his annual forecast, ended last year with giving what he called one of his most optimistic forecasts ever. We have tens of billions of dollars of investment either happening or projected, particularly in the area of energy transition, clean energy. For example, I was on the phone yesterday with folks who are with Copenhagen Infrastructure Partners, who are the backers of a $5 billion blue ammonia facility in St. Charles Parish. The liquid, the LNG facility in Plaquemines, Venture Global, is the single largest privately financed project in world history. We have tens of billions of carbon capture projects that are underway or being planned. So the exciting thing and what makes me optimistic, Errol, is that Louisiana has always been an energy state. Now we have a chance to be an all of the above clean energy state of the future. And that is something that has not been politicized here, because regardless of political stripes, everybody recognizes that there's simply economic opportunity, for example, in taking folks who have traditionally served the oil and gas sector and now serving the offshore wind sector. So I actually think that we are on the verge of an industrial renaissance in Louisiana, and that will benefit not just New Orleans or the region, but all of South Louisiana.
What industry is going to lead the renaissance?
It's going to be all of the energy sector. So it's going to be traditional oil being done in a lower carbon way, like LLOG is doing a repurposed rig in the Gulf that saves 70% on steel emissions. It's going to be LNG across South Louisiana, because we are both allowing Europe to wean itself off of Russian natural gas, but also allow China and Asia to convert to natural gas instead of coal, which is good for the environment. It's wind, where you have companies like Edison Schwess building massive boats for Danish wind company Ørsted. It is biofuels, like what's happening down in St. Bernard Parish with Chalmette Refining, where they're doing biodiesel. It is power to X, or green or blue hydrogen, like the $5 billion St. Charles project. It is the world's largest solar panel manufacturing facility in St. Mary Parish. It is EV battery manufacturer, like the one in Jefferson Parish, a Japanese company, Ube, that was just approved. All of these things together, all of which we have legitimate natural asset and historical skills in, collectively are what I think are going to generate all of the economic and job impact.
Why are these places here and not in Atlanta or Houston?
Because, you know, what's interesting is that even if you're going to a different form of energy, a lot of the basic skills required or assets required are the same. I'll give you a specific example. If you look at the first wind farm in America off the coast of Block Island, it's a small farm, but it's the first legitimate one. It was 90% built by Louisiana companies, companies like Gulf Island Fabrication, like Keystone Engineering, the vessels being built by companies like Edison Schwest. These are traditional oil and gas companies, but what they've discovered is all of the same skills and assets required to build and service oil rigs can be used to build and service offshore wind structures. So it's just a product extension, a transition for them. Or if you look at the production of green hydrogen or clean hydrogen, well, they can use our existing pipeline network, which is the densest in the world. Or if you look at carbon capture, well, one, we produce a lot of carbon that can be captured, but two, we have things like old oil wells and salt caverns that are natural places to store the carbon. So what's interesting is that a lot of our history as a traditional hydrocarbon economy translates very well into a lower carbon economy.
I remember when Atlanta, or Houston, by the way, I love to pick on Atlanta and Houston. Okay, so if I keep mentioning this, okay. But I remember when they were seemed to be insignificant towns. You never heard much about them. Then there was a period when they just like took off. All right. I remember a friend in school telling me something happened in Houston with like the fifth largest city in the country. They passed the law where they incorporated all those areas around there. And then Atlanta has just been enormous. And I wonder why. And I think some of your answers, but another reason that they've had space to expand and we haven't.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of it because that gives you cheap housing. So that's definitely part of it. And, you know, in Houston, the lack of planning has allowed for stuff to proliferate. But, you know, I don't know what you think about this, Errol, but I just read over break Lords of Misrule by James Gill. Have you read that? Yeah.
Yes.
You know, it tells the story of New Orleans and the story of Mardi Gras. And what it really comes out of that is that there is embedded in this place because of its history, a degree of tribalism and kind of cultural conservatism that has led many talented people who weren't part of those tribes or cultures to not be accepted. And so they went to Houston, where, for example, the only color that really matters is green, or they went to Atlanta, which was declared by Maynard Jackson or Andrew Young the city too busy to hate. And so what's interesting is that the way that we've preserved our culture here, which is wonderful and authentic and makes New Orleans sui generis, has also in some ways, I think, precluded the welcoming of outsiders and others, which is required for a growing dynamic economy. And places like Houston or Atlanta, which had nothing, didn't have the benefit or burden of that history. And so they're not as pretty, they're not as exciting, they're not as culturally rich. But from a business standpoint, they've managed to be more dynamic.
You know, what Gil wrote about, and a lot of people do that, every year at Carnival Time, there's somebody that does the Slam New Orleans article that comes out, right? And they all said the same thing pretty much. But to me, that's the old Mardi Gras. I mean, it's a different city. That's, you know, if you look at the age of Endymion and Bacchus and all those organizations, those aren't the old society crews.
Oh, no, there's no question. We're talking about echoes of the past, but you got to remember that the migration that occurred that went to Houston and Atlanta, this really hit its stride in the 80s. So we're talking about a while ago now. We're talking about 40 years ago, 45 years ago. But no, you're right. I mean, you know, when you look at parades, like, name it, like Bacchus tomorrow. I mean, you know, these are a far, far cry from, you know, the days of Comus and Pickwick, right? I mean, it's a big evolution. But the point is that there are these cultural echoes. I think another point, which is less cultural and more about natural resources, Errol, is New Orleans has been so blessed with natural resources that we've been able to extract from the ground or extract from the water, or in terms of culture, extract from our people. We did not necessarily have to have the structures and attitudes towards innovation that places like Houston or Atlanta or Iceland or Israel have had to have, because they haven't had anything. And so I think this is a real concept called the curse of riches. And I think to some degree, historically, that has held us back. I think evidence of that today is that there's still very few products where we add value as opposed to just process commodities in bulk. The only one that we do at scale is really coffee. But of course, it's when you're adding value that you create the margin that really makes you rich. And so, again, I think all those things that have made this place so successful in its for the first 300 years are things that are always going to be critical to us, but that we have to now build on by adding more innovation on top of.
And Atlanta and Houston both rather quickly built huge international airports. And there was always talk about doing it in New Orleans, but we have to drain like Pontchartrain to do it. I mean, it was those kind of things, you know? I mean, did that...
Yeah. You know, there's a story. So, I mean, one, it seems like it must have inhibited us. But on the other hand, Errol, like, you know, there's some very tiny, physically, compromised places like the Netherlands or like Singapore that seem to, have worked out creating wealth, right? But what happened was back when the FAA awarded the airport to Atlanta to be their major international airport, instead of anywhere else in the Southeast, which very much could have been New Orleans. I don't understand the politics that drove that, but that was clearly a critical thing that happened in DC that altered our future. We have to remind people, I'm sure you know this, that Delta Airlines is a Louisiana Airlines by birth, right? From Monroe. And now they hub out of Atlanta, the busiest airport in the world. So there have been these junctures where things have happened. I don't know that story about the airport and why it went to Atlanta. Maybe you do, but certainly that was a fateful decision relative to both communities.
Well, there is, I guess, a regional argument. If you look at the map, that Atlanta is sort of in the middle of the Southeast, I guess. It's more in the middle than New Orleans is, which you look at the map, New Orleans is down in the Gulf. I don't know if that was the point or not, but it's a good location to build an airport.
It is. I mean, it is, and it's got the land and the space. I think the real question for New Orleans is why we ceded the Gateway to the Americas title to Miami. That's one that was historically ours, of course, right? Going back to bananas and Union Fruit. And I'm not clear about what happened and why we allowed Miami to really become the entrepot for Central and South America, certainly South America. We're trying to get that back. We now have direct flights to Central America, but you remember on the old airport, there used to be that faded Gateway to the Americas sign on the side of Terminal C. Sure. And, again, I think that there is something to be said for being so blessed that you believe that because of our location in the river, we're always going to be blessed. And sometimes Avis overtakes Hertz, right? Because they're number two. Actually, Hertz is like almost bankrupt now, so a bad example.
I remember the newspaper seeing ads for like airlines like Taca and Loxa and Sasha, which were all Mexican and Central American lines. And they all flew to New Orleans. So if you wanted to go there, you went to New Orleans. Now, I don't even think those airlines exist anymore. And one thing that seemed to have happened is that United States Airlines pretty much took over those routes. And so if you want to go to Miami, or if you want to go to, if you want to go to South America, you could probably take, American Airlines through Miami, or I'm not sure it's flying Houston, but it seems like the American Airlines or the United States Airlines just showed a lot of muscle in there. I don't know what happened.
Well, that's right. Well, I mean, I'll give you an example, of it. So, yeah. So for example, United bought Continental, and then they bought Copa, and that kind of, monopolized that for a long time. In general, there's been a phenomenon in this country where consolidation of airlines, of banks, of law firms, nationalization of these firms, which kind of came out of the deregulation of the 80s, has hurt a lot of formerly great cities, not just New Orleans, but Baltimore, St. Louis, Detroit, Cleveland. The only one that seems to have escaped that is Pittsburgh, because it's gone from being a city really held in place by the business elite to one being held in place by a research elite, by Carnegie Mellon. But for most places, when they lost their bank headquarters, think about what King Milling did for this place after Katrina, right, as the president of Whitney. And that was, one, because he's King Milling, but two, because Whitney was the Bank of New Orleans, headquartered here. And so there was an alignment of interests. And when consolidations take those away, you lose the business leadership that tends to keep the political leadership in check, provides a lot of money, provides a lot of intellectual capital, provides a lot of philanthropy. And so that's also a phenomenon that has not just hurt New Orleans, but a lot of the older cities in this country.
So King Milling tried to just gel that leadership together. And
And I mean, King was really big on kind of starting the idea of coastal restoration, right? That was really his thought.
What a great family. And his wife, Ann Milling, was such a leader in redoing the zoo. I mean, they're just great people. I miss them. Now, we've talked about all of this and all these wind farms and things. We have not mentioned the word tourism, which seems like, you know, one of our big advantages. It may not be enough of an advantage, but how does that fit in all of this?
Well, I mean, tourism is the foundation of it all. It employs the most people outside of healthcare. And it is it's part and parcel of our brand. And one of the nice things that happened in 2023 is, you know, based on the efforts of folks at New Orleans and Company and the airport and our hospitality leadership, we saw tourism come back and surpass 2019 levels. Occupancy came back to 2019 in our hotels, but room rates were higher. The airport came back to 2019 employment numbers, but now with about 25% more international seats. The airport was voted best airport in North America. So I think what we saw in there, Errol, is that everything that COVID stole from us, intimacy, culture, the ability to make questionable decisions in public spaces, these are all things that New Orleans is best in the world at. And so people flocked back. And so I think that if you talk to any of our tourism partners and leaders, they'll say that 2023 was an exciting year because they saw that people still very much want what we have.
And it's significant that all of the major hotel chains are here. You know, it used to be among the majors, we had the Hilton and the Sheraton, but now I think all the big names are here.
Yeah, all the big ones are here. The Four Seasons has really given us a whole new level of product. The Caesars expansion is going to be beautiful down there right across the street from the Four Seasons. The Ritz-Carlton is doing an expansion. So we have our iconic hotels like the Roosevelt. We have our new boutique hotels like the St. Vincent and the Peter and Paul. And then we have our big national and international chains. And so, you know, our hotel stock is wonderful and keeps getting better. And then there's massive investment happening by Tulane into the charity hospital in that area, which is going to rejuvenate what's kind of been an urban blind spot for many, many years. The River District, Errol, incredibly exciting. One of the most exciting new neighborhoods in the country. $1.5 billion, live, work, play. We're keeping Shell here in the first new office building since 1989. So when I look at the investment in downtown New Orleans and also in Jefferson Parish, I think it's actually it's sending a very encouraging signal about confidence in the urban market.
So will this make the people who might leave Louisiana, will this make them more inclined to stay?
I think so. I mean, I think that if you look at what Governor Edwards was able to do in terms of stabilizing finances, stabilizing healthcare, stabilizing education, it feels that he did a lot of the cleanup he needed to do. And now Governor Edwards has a chance to come in and be more aggressive and go forward again. And to some degree, kind of tell the story we were telling first term Jindal, which is that New Orleans, or Louisiana rather, is kind of a kindler, gentler Texas, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the reality is that Austin is overripe. Houston is not a particularly lovely place to be. Mm-hmm. Dallas is boring. You know, people should want to come here. I think we just need a more proactive narrative about the wonderful reality about living here, and also about how things are so much better. If we don't tell that story, then people still believe the images they saw on CNN 10, even 20 years ago.
Yeah, and people still think that the streets are flooded. I mean, that lasted a long time.
But they still do.
Even those who know that the streets aren't flooded are still thinking there's a possibility that they'll flood again, that the whole thing can happen again. And from what I told by people who know better, that if there would be the exact same situation as Katrina, we wouldn't have the same result anymore.
Absolutely not. No. I mean, you know, so it's funny. We were in London recently with the new insurance commissioner, Temple, meeting with Lloyd's, talking about how to lower property insurance. And somebody in one of the meetings said, well, he said it with a very kind of public school British accent, you know, well, you haven't even done anything to help, you know, to help make the city any safer since Katrina. And we said, well, that's nonsense. We've put in $15 billion plus, and Katrina would not happen again, period, full stop. The things that caused Katrina, which was that the outfall canals turned into infall canals and the T walls tipped over, simply would not happen again because of the Great Wall of New Orleans and because of the, you know, the canals are cut off. And so we just have to keep telling that story because the images of Katrina are pretty indelible. And it's going to take time and telling the other story to help, you know, expunge them.
I remember the big news operations like NBC and all networks actually opened offices, opened bureaus in New Orleans for a couple of years after that because they just thought that there was such a big story here. And it
Well,
was a
you
big
know,
story, but it
there's,
wasn't the one they were looking for.
yeah, I mean, there was an element of disaster porn that made it very attractive. And that was, you know, I got tired of seeing Anderson Cooper in his tight black t-shirt standing on the levee. You know, I want some Anderson, if you're on the levee, you're never going to flood. You know, you're 40 feet above sea level, right? You know, the reality is that we've got a very good story to tell about infrastructure. We've got a very good story to tell about our economic diversification, not just energy, but we're going to put the first African American and woman on the moon in 2025 and then humankind on Mars. We've got a growing and diverse tech sector with the best tech incentive in all of North America, a 25% cash rebate for doing programming in Louisiana. And we do have an authenticity and a warmth, which is increasingly in scarce supply in this homogeneous and divisive world that we live in. So, a lot of this is just about better storytelling and getting the narrative out there, I think.
And that's your job, to go out and spread the word. When
It's our job, yeah.
you went to London, did you all take that British Airlines nonstop?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I love that flight.
That's a great
It's a
service,
game
huh?
changer.
Yeah.
It's particularly a convenience coming back because you get to fly into New Orleans instead of, you know, Atlanta or Miami or DC. It's a game changer. It, you know, to fall asleep in Kenner and wake up in Heathrow is a thing.
I mean, I hope they're pleased with it, and I hope they maybe expand it one day. It's almost been more than that. I mean, there was talk for a while that Air France was going to come in, but I don't think it ever happened. Well, I know it didn't happen.
We had a couple of Air France flights for special occasions. I flew it. It was amazing going to Charles de Gaulle from our airport. The challenge that we have right now is a question about whether there is enough aggregate demand to support both London and Paris at the same time. And I think people are being careful with our baby, which is the British Airways flight, and they just don't want to make sure they don't cannibalize it too much. But over time, I think you'll see us having service to Paris and Frankfurt.
And we had Frankfurt before for a while before Katrina came, and that never returned. But
No, well, we had Condor for a little while. It was a summer airline, but their parent company went bankrupt. The flight was doing fine. But Frankfurt's a great location because it gives you all of Central and Eastern Europe.
it's a hub for Europe. Let me ask you about one more thing, and I know you have to move on. But whenever people talk about economic development in New Orleans area, they always talk about the East. You know, there's so much potential out there. But yeah, it's never really happened. I mean, the East has never really realized the dreams I think people have. I mean, there was a brief period when Mischa was there, people say, oh, this is the future, but it's not happening. Why?
I think at a very practical level, transportation connectivity is a problem. I think that at a higher level, political dysfunction that has made the place historically not as coherent and powerful as it should be. You know, crime and the reputation of crime is the third one that there is just a we need a more positive reputation. I mean, I half jokingly have said that if I were king for a day or mayor, I would I'd rebrand New Orleans East, call it East Town or something, because we kind of need a hard reset. There are great communities there. There's actually a reasonable income level. It just needs to be packaged and sold in a better way. And some of the practical problems like transportation, public transportation access, and crime in places like Littlewood have to be tamped down. But in terms of expansion, in terms of industrial areas, even what's being described for Six Flags doing an amusement park, these things make a lot of sense to me. It's a great location, and I do remind people that Jazzland was profitable pre-Katrina. It wasn't their most profitable property because it was too small, but it was working. It was making money, and they were about to put a water park in when Katrina hit. So I think with a proper management and TLC, that New Orleans East can do better than just fine.
I think that high rise is a real psychological barrier.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's a high rise, right? I mean, you feel like you are going, you feel like you're going into space. So, but I don't think that's going to change unless we pull out the gondola from the World's Fair and set that up.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so I guess overall you feel optimistic.
Yeah. I mean, I really felt that coming out of 2022, things were rough. We were at a tipping point, and we asked people to come together. And with groups like the NOLA Coalition, which is now up to 570 members, we have come together and we are seeing improvements. And I happen to agree with Lauren Scott that I think the forecast is quite optimistic on quality of life issues, on sector issues like energy. And so I think that there is a lot of good energy and optimism in the room, and that it's justified. I really do. I'm a good storyteller, but a bad liar, Errol. So if I didn't feel that, I wouldn't say it.
Let me ask you, I'll let you go after this, but I think it's a good story if it's true. Were you at this meeting? There was a story that right after Katrina, that Tom Benson was thinking about moving the Saints out of New Orleans and bringing them to San Antonio. And he really wanted to. He was hearing bad stories about the dome and everything else. And there was this meeting, and Paul Tagliabue, the NFL commissioner, came in, a bunch of business leaders, and he told Benson, "You're not going to move the franchise. You got to be here." Were you at that meeting?
No, I wasn't, but I've heard about that meeting from credible sources. And I think that Paul Tagliabue is an unsung hero because he recognized that it was not it would be terrible for the NFL to pull the Saints out of New Orleans at a time like this, to basically rip the heart out of an injured city. And so the NFL, I think, gets a lot of credit. Business leadership gets a lot of credit. And, you know, and eventually, obviously, Mr. Benson made the right decision.
Yeah. And he also put money into repairing the Superdome. And
Superdome's going to be beautiful. $500 million. Yeah, I mean, Superdome's getting $500 million. It's a gorgeous structure, great location. That whole area is going to be, I think, totally revitalized. Hopefully we do something with City Hall.
Just one more sidelight to the Tagliabue thing. You know, he took charge of that. And in that next season, the Saints did play out of San Antonio, but with the understanding they were coming back. And when they did come back, he created the schedule, because the Superdome wasn't quite ready yet, that their first, I think, four games were on the road, which is unusual. But then that fifth game, and if it happens, they won them all, okay, which is amazing, okay? Maybe the first three games. Anyway, they came into it undefeated. So there was this incredible Monday night football. The Saints, after being away for essentially over a year, play Atlanta in the Superdome, Monday night football. And that was the game where there was that block punt and the touchdown, like in the first minute or so, and the Saints were ahead. They never looked back. It was one of the most incredible football moments ever.
That was September 25th, 2006. And at that game, Errol, everybody was crying because they knew that meant that we weren't going to lose the Saints and they were going to come back better than ever. And that by metaphorical extension, we weren't going to lose the city and it was going to come back better than ever. It was the greatest example of sports as metaphor that I've ever witnessed.
Hello, man. Thanks for all you're doing. And, you know, I've always said cities need people. I think about this, political people. I think I wish there were political people who really represented and spoke up better for the city and who the people can respect. And that's both local and national. I just don't think we have enough of that. But I'm glad that at the business level, there's people like you, because you are that kind of person that could really be a spokesman that can rally support. And, you know, that's very important. So
thank you.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate it. And I try to fulfill my role as fake politician with dignity and aplomb. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Michael.
Thanks for the time. Ciao, ciao. Bye-bye. Okay.
Thanks for listening to Louisiana Insider. Subscribe, like, and rate our show where you listen to your podcasts, and follow us on social media at Louisiana Life Mag. Executive producer for Louisiana Insider is Kelly Massico, in cooperation with Louisiana Life Magazine. For subscription information to Louisiana Life, call 504-828-1380. Our theme music was provided by Rich Collins. Hey, that's me. Join us again next week for more discoveries inside Louisiana.